to EggPod Express with me, Chris Shaw. EggPod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist related to this particular issue. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. This is part two of my interview with Mark Lewison. So let's start with the top 10 bands in the Merseybeat popularity poll.
Hello, little girl. Hello, little girl. When I see you every day, I say, hello, little girl. When you're passing on your way, I say, hello, little girl. If I see you passing by, I cry.
The 4J's become the Foremost.
Yeah, they're at number 10.
Yeah, so they were signed by Brian as the Foremost.
Yeah, and again, Hello Little Girl, I'm In Love. They've given these...
Yeah, we're given two songs. Well, and in Here, Here, There and Everywhere as well in 66.
Was that before the Beatles?
They got it before the Beatles version was out, but it kind of didn't do anything at all. There was some kerfuffle over it, and it's in my notes. Did it even come out? Yes, it did come out, but it didn't get anywhere. But their time had gone by 66.
Yeah.
The Foremost.
Nine Farron's Flamingos.
Yeah, Farron and the Flamingos, it says here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awful name for a band, really. but well respected and well liked. And Farron was a big part of the scene. I remember seeing Farron at a Merseycats gig in around 2005. Bill Ruffley was his name, I think.
William Farron Ruffley. Yes, correct, you're right.
Yeah.
Nicknamed the Panda-Footed Prince of Prance by Bob Wooler.
Yeah, Panda-Footed Prince of Prance. Farron used to be at the very early Beatles conventions in the late 70s, and we always thought of, you know, we young people thought of them as quite old, but they were probably only about 40.
I know. You know,
if that. Probably lower, but probably even 33, 34.
Yeah. Follies of Youth.
Yeah.
Eight, we have the Strangers.
Yeah, Strangers never really made it. No. But the guy, Joe Fagan, went on to become an actor. And I think he was in Alvida St. Pet.
Oh, he wrote the music, didn't he, Joe Fagan?
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
I know there's a connection.
That's yes, Living All Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Living All Right, yeah, which is a big hit.
what a link.
Liverpool's people with a lot of talent there, always.
Some other guy now.
Number seven, the Big Three.
Yeah. Who had been Cass and the Casanovas, and then Cass had gone, and they reduced to a trio who have their part in things. They were the second act signed by Brian, just before Gerry and the Pacemakers.
And they're mentioned in the by Bill Harry. They are actually mentioned. But he says the Big Three, too, deserve credit for being so high up in this poll. Being a trio in a competitive field where so many other groups have larger lineups places them at a disadvantage. They have come through with flying colours. And
it's like a sports report, that, isn't it?
You're thinking about the motor racing and ice hockey.
Zone. Everybody says they were never recorded properly, that they were much, much more powerful on stage than they ever were on vinyl. And I can well believe that. Even the great Decca EP at the Cavern somewhat neutralises their sound. It was just about recording techniques, really. The Decca singles the band hated. The ones that they did when Brian managed them. I don't think Brian got the Big Three right, but I think they were probably unmanageable because they were just tough bastards. Unruly tough bastards. And there was a code towards being a success then. They weren't prepared to play the game. it was probably very nice of them to stick two fingers up to Brian, but at the end of the day, they didn't make any money. And that's what most people are in it for. You want to make some money from it. You may be dizzy, man, please.
At six,
King Size.
King Size Taylor and the Dominants. What a voice.
Fantastic voice. Great band as well. Real good chugging, hard-rocking Liverpool band. Proper guitar band. King Size, indomitable personality. I found him personally quite aggressive, provocative. He would say things with an edge, which gets a bit tiresome after a while. I went to his house, I felt quite vulnerable. Like he might beat me up at any moment. We talked about him on when I did the egg pod, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He swapped meat for meat.
Yeah, that was a Spencer Lee phrase, swap beat for meat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And obviously the Star Club tapes, he was instrumental. But I think as a singer, fantastic. Hey!
It was well reckoned. The thing about some guys are respected by other musicians, and he was always respected by other musicians. So they knew what they were talking about. And I saw him sing in Hamburg in about 2006. He still had it. He absolutely still had it. At the same time, you could see why he'd never become a star.
Yeah.
The talent was there, but it wasn't a star.
I wonder why he got so edgy with you then.
He was one of those. Quite a few of the Mersey bands resented the Beatles because they were like, that could have been me. Mm. You know, why was it them and not me? And you would get people who would say things like, you know, the Beatles, it could have been any other group. It could have been, you know, it could have been us just as much as it could have been them. No, it really couldn't. It really couldn't. For reasons that you're not necessarily aware of, they had talents that go exceedingly far beyond what you've got. Nothing personal, but they just did. And it was the combination, the chemistry, the look, the name, the sound, everything. They had the complete package and these other guys didn't.
And I guess coupled with the fact that the only time anybody wants to interview him is talking about the Beatles.
Yes.
That must eat away at him, perhaps.
Oh, this stuff did eat away at those people. I mean, I rest in peace, a great friend of mine, Andre Barreau of the Bootleg Beatles.
Yes.
Often played on the same bill as the Searchers and the Merseybeats and whoever, you know, the groups who were still going or making money from it, still gigging in the late 20th century, early 21st, like the Searchers. Mm. And they might say on microphone, oh, the Beatles were great, you know, and all that. But backstage in the dressing room, Andre was telling me they were full of bitchiness about the Beatles, these other bands.
Oh.
Because they resented it. It was all about them. I mean, the fact that they even had a career still after 40 years owed entirely to the Beatles, making that whole genre of music popular.
Yeah, yeah.
But they wouldn't consider that. They wouldn't consider that. They would just consider it as too much attention being
That's
paid to one band in particular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you introduced me to Andre. It was after the 62 show or the 63 show you
did. My Evolver show. Yeah.
And he'd said he'd listened to Egg Pod and it was like the second best thing that happened to me that day. So thank you for that.
I have to ask what the first thing was.
The show.
Oh, great.
I didn't want to blow up your...
No, thank you. Thank you.
But I did.
Johnny Sandon and the Searchers at five. That's when they were backing, the Searchers were backing Johnny Sandon.
Yes.
Who never really made it. He became Johnny Sandon and the Remo Four. a long career, but in terms of hits, no. Signed by Pi, but no.
And the Searchers obviously went on to do a bit of that.
The Searchers had a proper recording career and played at Glastonbury in 2025.
How many
original Searchers are there? One or two? Two, I think.
Which is pretty good going for a band from this era.
They did an absolute final farewell, never gonna play again tour in 22 or 3, ending with a show at the Philharmonic Hall. And Spencer Lee went there and interviewed them, and that's it. The final, we're not doing it again. But it was such a popular tour, they did another one.
Ah, oh, superb.
So it goes back to Monty Python and their first farewell tour. You know, back in 1974, they had it cracked already. That's what you have to do.
Yeah. Well, like that.
You keep saying goodbye.
Yeah, I've still got the vinyl from 1984, the very final Who show. It's called Who's Last.
Yeah.
Never to see them live again.
Yeah. Until next year.
Yeah. Oh, fair play.
Well, I can tell by the way that you look at me. I can tell, pretty baby, it's so plain to see.
We've spoken about that before, number four, Rory Storm.
So Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, who had been slipping. The thing about Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, from I never saw them play, but those who saw them play, and indeed it's mentioned in Merseybeat if you read every page of every issue, that they never changed their set. So if you saw them in January and you saw them again in May and you saw them again in November, you saw the same thing. You didn't get any variation. That's not clever. Because people are going to go, I've seen them. Who else is on? You've got to keep shaking it up. And the Beatles knew that better than anybody. You could see them twice on the same day and see two completely different sets. And that was intuitive thinking on the Beatles' part.
Especially as so many bands were doing the same songs as well.
Yeah.
Again, have a look on this playlist I've done. There's a lot of bands that you may and may not have heard of, but they're doing a lot of songs that the Beatles were doing live or from the Star Club and stuff like that, so... I think Rory, they did, I think this is later, Lend Me a Comb.
Yeah.
But it would have been in their set, I'm sure.
A lot of bands heard the Beatles do it, of course. Paul always says that Freddie and the Dreamers got If You Gotta Make a Fool of Somebody from them, rather than from James Ray, for example.
We have the Remo Four.
The Remo Four, who were quite well known to the Beatles, well respected guys. They were the Fender group in Liverpool, and Fender guitars were really rare because there'd been a ban on importation of American guitars. So you had to send away for them. I think that maybe the ban had been lifted, but nonetheless, they were scarce. And they were good players, the Remo Four, and two of them had been at the Institute with Paul and George.
Yeah.
So they knew them from school. Brian signed the Remo Four as well.
Yeah.
He managed the Remo Four right the way to his death, Brian, in 67.
Tip of my tongue.
Well, that was Tommy Quickly. They became Tommy Quickly's backing group on record. I'm not sure they're on that one, but they're on other records of Tommy Quickly's.
But they did do a version of I Wish I Could Shimmy Like My Sister Kate,
yeah.
As well, that's another song that's...
The Olympics.
Being spun around the cabin. And,
yeah.
And obviously another artist eventually ended up on Apple in 1968.
Kind of. They played on the Wonderwall sessions, didn't they? Because they could play, and they were NEMs, and
reason why he would have chosen that particular band? Is there anything documented on that?
The Remos, they could have chosen anybody who could play, because there were lots of players by 67, 68, but they were still part of the stable, really. I mean, with Brian's death, I think that brought it to an end, but nonetheless, they were still part of the stable. Like Jackie Lomax was NEMS before Apple. But the Remos weren't signed to Apple, but they were around. So they did that track that eventually came out in the first place, was it called?
Yes.
Around the turn of this century, something like that. There was a sudden unreleased track from the Wonderwall sessions with George producing it.
Yeah. One of my favourite albums. Let's have a little bit of rhythm. The top two, we don't need to say much. I think everybody would know Gerry and the Pacemakers at number two and the Beatles at number one.
Yeah, Gerry and the Pacemakers, not yet signed by Brian. Brian signed the Beatles in, well, he became their manager in all but contract from about mid-November 61. Gerry and the Big Three are signed in June 62, and then he begins to sign others in 63, if I'm remembering the chronology correctly. So he's not yet the manager of Gerry, and the Beatles were fearful, Paul in particular, that Gerry would top this poll. And I think he was, right through until late 63, he was still a bit fearful of Gerry becoming bigger than they were, but we can see a million reasons why they were never as big as the Beatles.
Well, I can kind of see it because I've been listening to the debut album, Gerry and the Pacemakers, and it's brilliant. It's a really, really good, really strong, tight album.
Yeah.
You can't compare it to Please Please Me, but it's, as debut albums go, it's a phenomenal album.
Yeah.
Outstanding. You can fool me, you can fool me by looking cool. Well, I can see you care for. So they were, I can see it from Paul's perspective. He might have seen them as a threat, at least.
They never engaged the public in the same way. No. People bought the singles because they were good singles until they weren't good singles, and then they weren't bought. But they never had the loyalty of the public.
Mm.
You know, they were just a good hit group. And the Beatles were number one. Well, all four ads at the bottom have Beatle connections. They played the Glen Park Club. I never was able to find out the date, but they played the Glen Park Club in Southport. They played the Storyville as the Storyville. Storyville obviously suggesting jazz, but it was becoming clear that beat was the music that really brought people in through the turnstiles, as it were. So they played there in Temple Street, became the Iron Door. Peter Kay Photography, he was engaged by Brian to take great pictures of the Beatles, which he did, starting with, well, not starting with, but including the pictures of them out and about in Liverpool just before Love Me Do comes out. And Joe's Restaurant was the only place in Liverpool where you could eat late. The Beatles led a nocturnal lifestyle from very early on because they didn't need to get up early, because the earliest they ever needed to get up was to play the Cavern. So then they'd get up at 11 in the morning or something like that. But if they'd not got a lunchtime gig, they would not get up until the mid-afternoon, because they were out until very, very late and only going to bed at breakfast time.
Yeah.
And they would be eating at Joe's. And there are pictures of the Beatles in Joe's with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes and Iris Caldwell, Rory's sister.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of pictures of them there. And so one of the early polls questionnaires was favourite food, and John said curries. And he would have had curries at Joe's. And Paul, I think, mentions Joe's in on Saturday Club or one of those interviews with Brian Matthew.
Well, that's the one where he's saying, do you miss anything before you were famous? Oh, riding on a bus and all that sort of...
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, with Brian Matthew, yeah.
Yeah.
Joe's calf. It might be Top Gear. Top Gear or Saturday Club. It's one of those late 64 interviews, November. And so it was a real place, Joe's restaurant at 139 Duke Street. Yeah. And Joe ended up being co-owner of the cavern.
It's small
world.
There's
a picture of him on page 6.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah. The minutiae. It's relentless. And tedious.
What about the simpler things of life, like...
Like riding on a bus.
Yeah, or going to just about any restaurant you
can. Well, you miss those sort of things.
We go to certain ones.
And we go to ones where the people there are so snobby, they're the type who pretend they don't know us, so we have a good time. Because they're
Joe's
pretending
calf.
They don't know us.
Yeah, that figures.
See,
Joe's calf. Social comment, that, you know.
It is.
NEMS was a chart compiler for all sorts of publications. Used to provide charts to, I think, Melody Maker and Record Mirror in the late 50s and was a chart return shop. But I'm going to jump ahead here and say that the still perpetrated myth that he bought 10,000 copies of Love Me Do to massage it into the charts is complete nonsense. He did not. Do not respect any book that tells you otherwise.
I can name a few.
Yeah, I can name most of them, actually, but it's not true.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't do it.
I wonder where that started. It must have been...
It started very, very early because Brian is not really a part of this scene at this moment. He's edging into it as we look at it at the end of 61, beginning of 62. But it breaks very, very big nationally during 1963. And one man is managing all the acts that are big. Successive number ones for the Beatles and Jerry and the Pacemakers and Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas. Towards the end of the year, he launches Cilla Black, one man, and there was tremendous jealousy on Merseyside for Brian Epstein. And people started to make up lies about him.
Right.
Rumours took hold about, oh, he does this, he does that, and no one was checking the rumours. Mm. And they were allowed to settle and become fertile, and they were never true, but it was based on jealousy and misinformation that was maliciously spread and just took root. It's incumbent on writers to be sure of themselves before they put these things into print. And unfortunately, over the years, we've had people who don't care.
More of which later, after the recording. More articles in here. The one I did laugh at was Mersey Roundabout. This is by Virginia.
Bill's girlfriend.
Girlfriend at the time, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at this point, it can't be emphasised enough how important Mersey Beat's publication was to all the local bands. And in the letters page, you'd see friends of different bands saying, please, can we have articles? So in the previous, not this issue, but the previous one, Virginia in her column was very enthusiastic and she'd written, the Mersey Beat Christmas party will take place at 11 p.m. on Friday, the 22nd of December. For Merseyside, live entertainment folk only. The party should prove a very entertaining affair. Tickets are obtainable only from Mersey Beat and they cost 10 shillings each. As there are only 150 tickets available, we would suggest that entertainers contact us as soon as possible. The results of the Mersey Beat popularity poll will be announced at the party. And I would like to take the opportunity to say that, as yet, no one knows the results. The results of the poll will be fair, and we invite anyone who doubts to come along to the office to examine them. And then in this issue, it's a follow-up comment. She says... And it's quite an understandably narkier tone. She writes, our biggest disappointment at Christmas time came when we had to postpone the Christmas party. This was due to the apathy and disinterest of certain groups who refused to come to us for support and lend their support. Let us at least hope that they are not so hypocritical as to come to us for support in the future. No one was interested.
Yeah, just apathy. It just looks like the event never happened because no one was interested. She actually does mention here certain groups refused to come along and lend their support. One of them may have been the Beatles. It would have been at Oral Park Ballroom, which was a venue the Beatles never played, funnily enough. I don't know why they never did, but they never did. People say they saw them there, but I don't think that's right.
Right.
One person says it. But I think had the Beatles wanted to play there, it would have gone ahead. There must have been something about the Beatles winning it and not wanting to take part that made them think, why are we bothering?
Which would then explain Bill Harry's editorial.
What, not mentioning them at all?
Well, if he and Virginia had planned to organise this, there must be a bit of, oh, those buggers, they've won this. Right, I'm not going to mention in the...
No, Bill's never said that. Neither Bill nor Virginia has ever said that. But maybe they wouldn't want to say it because it's about the Beatles not showing them support. But I've never seen a ticket. They said they printed tickets. I've never seen an illustration of a ticket. I've never seen an example of one on the marketplace. Mm. So it just didn't happen. We wouldn't even know about it had she not written, or had he and then she not written that didn't happen.
No.
But that's a shame. There was an event for the Merseybeat poll a year later in December 62. There was one, the Majestic Ballroom in Birkenhead, and we've got pictures of that. Mm. They never had another one after that. In fact, Merseybeat, I think it ran a poll in 63, but there was no special event for it. But a pity.
Yes.
Looks like Bob Wooler would have been the MC for it as well, because he's mentioned here.
Yeah.
I want to go back to Virginia's column, Merseybeat Roundabout. Mm. In all newspapers in those days, generally speaking, the most interesting pieces were in the news roundups. The NME one was called Alley Cat. Yeah. Alley because of Tin Pan Alley Cat. Stop Pressings was the one in Disc. Was the one in Record Mirror was The Face. And in Melody Maker, it was Raver. And Virginia did Mersey Roundabout. And you get dot, dot, dot. So did you know so and so and so and so? It's one line, dot, dot, dot. And it's not enough to sustain an article. But they put it down. And sometimes you get the most interesting things.
Yes.
Including in this very issue. It says, top of the final column, the fourth column, Pete Best was also feeling bad, and Ringo Starr took over the Skins at the Beatles' Christmas party.
Yes. Yes.
I think this was the first time Ringo ever played with the Beatles. And my only knowledge of Ringo playing with the Beatles on December the 27th, 1961, is that bit by Virginia, that little droplet she put into history there.
Yeah. It's right at the end of the article. It's almost like a forgotten...
It's not so much forgotten. She might have just been typing them in the order that she received them. I don't know. But whatever it is, she's typed it there. And the Beatles' Christmas party was an event in the Cavern on December the 27th. And that told me that Ringo played. Mm. And I don't think there was one beforehand. So that is a historical fact there.
Wowzers.
Yeah. That's what I got from reading this carefully. Yeah.
There's no other way of reading it. Yeah.
Well, you know, your eyes can just skim over it and you can miss it, but it's worth reading.
Yeah.
I didn't feel I could write Tune In unless I read every Merseybeat, because otherwise I might miss something. And indeed, I would have missed that.
Yeah.
You know.
That's a book in itself.
Yeah, so thank you, Virginia, for that. I got to know Bill and Virginia.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, in the 80s, because they came down to London in about 66, 7. Mm. And Bill was part of the music industry. You know, he was a publicist, a PR man, Bill Harry Public Relations. And he wrote, and then he started to write Beatle books in the 80s, particularly. He was quite prodigious.
Well, understandably, he's a writer.
He's a gatherer of information, is Bill. That's his speciality, is gathering information.
Well, much as yourself, I mean, my old Beatles books, as those articles by you.
Yeah.
In there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was also an information gatherer, and I still am. But these days I write it long form.
Would you say that the research that you did, or the notes that you had for the reissues of the Beatles book,
yeah,
is that like the beginning of Tune In, really, isn't it? You must be using some of that.
No, not really. No, my early writing was all about information, and I'm still very much interested in information, but now I want to tell it within a proper... history, whereas in those days I was more into lists and dates and alphabetical orders and you know, chronologies and such like. But these days it's a bit more rounded than that, but it's the same process.
Page 6,
yeah.
You mentioned it before, there's an ad for Lord Woodbine.
Lord Woodbine in double quotes, yeah, Lord Woodbine.
Lovely photo of Lee Rutherford and Sheena.
Yeah.
At the odd spot.
Jazz, yeah.
There's a lot of jazz. I mean, this must have been the time when, obviously, like the Cavern, the famous story, isn't it? They stopped doing jazz and then started doing more beat. But I think jazz didn't, like the skiffle bands used to be inserts in between jazz numbers.
That's right. Sort of
needled its way in.
Yeah, between, while the band is over in the grapes getting tanked. on a few pints of brown, the skiffle group would get up and play a few songs, yeah.
But there's still very much a crossover of jazz and beat in this issue.
Jazz was big on Merseyside, and as it was everywhere, indeed. So there were lots of venues that played jazz. The Odd Spot Club, which became Beat by about March of 62. The Beatles played there a couple of times. Pictures of the Beatles playing the Odd Spot. But at this point, you can see it's only jazz bands playing there, including the Royal Caribbean Steel Band.
Yes.
On January the 7th. But with varying membership. I don't think Woodbine was with them every gig, but he was, you know, clearly involved with them.
Yeah.
At coffee clubs. John did a spoof of Mersey, what you can see on Merseyside in one of these issues of Merseybeat, which ended up in his own right. It's based on a real thing. The Mandolin Club was an afternoon drinking club where Bob Willer talks about the Beatles going there to the Mandolin in 61, just along the street from where Ringo used to work in the factory, although he'd left by then, but the same street. Well, almost the same street.
The Black Cat, which is England's premier country and western club.
Yeah, because Liverpool was, you know, it had these, you wouldn't say a scene exactly, but there were clubs, there were venues, there were people who wanted to go and hear country music.
I'm sure Ringo would have frequented that at some point.
I bet he did. I've never heard him talk about it, but I bet he did. Yeah. I mean, the real thing to do would be to go through this issue with McCartney or Ringo.
Would it now?
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I can't speak for them because I don't know how age is diminishing their memories. But 20 years ago, if you'd gone through one of these with Paul, you would have got great results. And maybe you still would. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, there's Joe with his twiddly moustache.
Oh, Joe, there he is.
That's Joe who owned Joe's Caff. Yeah. Joe's Restaurant, as it was known, but Joe's Caff as they knew it.
Social comment, that.
Yeah, yeah. And who ended up being co-owner of the Cavern from 66 when Ray McFall went bankrupt. Ray McFall owns Merseybeat by this point.
Yes. Yeah.
The implication is this is Bill Harris' paper. No, it's his idea and his work, but he didn't own it. He never owned it. It was owned by Ray McFall. And it was Ray McFall who sold it to Brian Epstein in 64. So Brian Epstein becomes the owner of this newspaper from 64.
Because following that, then it evolved into...
It evolves, Music it gets Echo. Retitled Music Echo, and then it folds with Disc to become Disc and Music Echo, yeah.
So, yeah, it's weird to think it going all through the 60s as well, you know.
Yeah, and Bill would still write about Liverpool, but it would just be a column there, because, to be honest, not many people were that interested, not nationally. Maybe in Liverpool they were. And part of the problem with Merseybeat, I would say, and this is not a criticism, but it's just an inevitability, is that it didn't move on quickly enough. Mm-hmm. And Bill assumed there would be widespread interest in, you know, Sonny Webb and the Cascades or the Denisons or Ian and the Zodiacs, and there wasn't.
No.
You know.
There is now.
Well, not really. Yeah, there's historical interest, but, you know, in terms of paying your money for a copy of this, not many people really wanted to buy, read about King Size in 65. It needed to move on. And so Brian Epstein moved it on, and Bill was very unhappy with that. But you can understand why. And bad-mouthed Brian in a lot of interviews, Bill. But I think it was just something that had to happen.
It's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah.
Talking to Brian on page 7.
Yeah.
There we have go. One of his articles. He's talking about his top pops of 1961.
Yeah.
And there's some interesting songs in here.
Yeah. My top pops of 1961, Brian Epstein. There he is, taken by Albert Marion. So the man who took the photographs of the Beatles, he got the gig because Brian already knew him, because he had already taken Brian's picture. Happy New Year to everyone, says Brian at the end. No mention here of the Beatles. No, there is mention of the Beatles.
Right,
there is mention
end.
Right at the end about the Beatles' My Bonnie being issued on January the 6th, he says, which actually was a one day out. It was the 5th.
Yeah.
And he says, this could be a big year for the Beatles, whose records I look forward to seeing in the charts in 1962. Records plural. So yes. Even beyond My Bonnie, he's hoping they'll make another and maybe more than one other. But that at the end, at the beginning of the column, he talks about the 10 records I will remember of 1961, a purely personal choice. He's astonished that Anthony Newley's What Kind of Fool Am I did not make number one. Anthony Newley had opened the NEMS store on Whitechapel in 1960. He was the celebrity who came along and opened the shop. He thinks that 1961 has been a poor year pop-wise, but he calls Dave Brubeck's Take Five a phenomenon, which it was. And its appeal has staggered the musical world, which it did. And then he goes on to say, Brian, in a very interesting wording, it's my own belief that here was a brilliant example of a disc being presented to the public at the right moment. And you can see why it's much less of a leap for Brian Epstein to become a manager than is usually portrayed, because he could be talking here of a Beatles record in 1963.
Yes. Yeah.
It shows a mode of thinking that is more just beyond retail.
Mm. Oh, right? Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a regular thing, wasn't it? He was picking through the songs of the week.
Well, if you go into the 62 issues, you can hear the Beatles' opinions about records coming through his words, because he starts to like what they like. Yes. Because they're such enthusiasts for the Marvelettes and all of that, that he begins to enthuse for the Marvelettes in his column. And you know it's John and Paul and George going, oh, we love this, listen to this, Brian. Yeah. And Brian, oh, it is quite nice. Yeah. And then he writes about it as my current favourite is. So, and it's really their taste that he's promulgated.
Take good care of my baby. Please don't ever make her blue. Just tell her that you love her. Make sure you're thinking of her in everything you say and do.
There's a couple of songs on this list that he's picked.
Yeah.
Primarily.
I see where you're going.
Bobby V, Take Good Care of My Baby.
Yeah.
And Dinah Washington, September in the Rain.
Yeah.
So this was, what was this, 4th of January?
Yeah. But probably written in December.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But two songs from the Beatles Decca audition.
Yeah.
Would he have had any influence?
Well, it was always said and always held against Brian, and I think the Beatles may have been partly responsible for this misconception, that he insisted on their repertoire at the Decca test, and that part of the reason they failed it was because they didn't do the songs they would normally have done in the cavern. This is a myth. This is untrue. They did their set. The only suggestion that Brian made to the Beatles Decca repertoire was that they should do three of their own songs, which they wouldn't have done otherwise. Mm. And so they did Hello Little Girl, Like Dreamers Do, and Love of the Loved. And it was by doing their own songs that they end up getting a recording contract with George Martin. So thankfully, Brian suggested that they do their own songs, because that was the only change he made. These songs were already in the Beatles repertoire, September in the Rain and Take Good Care of My Baby. Possibly they're in the list because Brian heard the Beatles doing them.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't know.
And there's some other songs that leap out at me. As a, bear in mind Brian's personal life, which was very personal at the time, legally. He's picked What Kind of Fool Am I?
Yeah, well, it's a theatrical song, isn't it?
Really? Yeah, and Climb Every Mountain.
Yeah.
And it's all these sort of very, especially the Anthony Newley song, it's some of the lyrics in that. It's What Kind of Fool Am I Who Never Fell in Love? Seems that I'm the only one that I've been thinking of. What kind of man is this? An empty shell, a lonely cell in which an empty heart must dwell. What kind of clown am I? And all that, this kind of...
Yeah.
That must have had some emotional impact on him.
Ah, I couldn't say. But you could see why it might have done.
Yeah.
He knew Newley. He and Newley had been back to the house for a meal after he had opened the NEMS shop. He writes about it in A Cellar Full of Noise. Well, Derek wrote about it. About Newley being the kind of an interesting star figure, because he was a very normal man to talk to, a very ordinary guy. Not that he wasn't brilliant, Anthony Newley, but back at the house, he was not just a star. He was actually approachable and intelligent and articulate. And I think, again, when he met the Beatles, he realised that they were also, you know, they had the capacity to become huge stars, but at the same token, they were down to earth.
Because this would have been around Gurney Slade, was that around this time, I think?
Yeah, the TV series, TV comedy, yes. Well, Newley was late 50s on Decca, wasn't he? He was a Decca recording star who was becoming a film and stage presence. Mm.
Talking of Beatley things, which somehow we have, I don't know why, but there's another article called Parisian Rock.
Yeah.
Which was written by a certain P. McCartney.
Yeah.
Uncredited.
Yeah, how crazy that it's uncredited.
But then Bill Harry's editorial is.
Yeah, it's It's just a bit of a strange thing. It absolutely begs a byline, this, because it's written in the first person.
Yes.
So you want to know who's written it, but it doesn't have one. But never mind. We know that Paul wrote it, and it's about John and Paul's trip to Paris, that very important trip to Paris that they did in the first 2 weeks of October 1961, without which it may not have gone forward. For a start, they come back with the hairstyle from Jürgen. But also the information in this piece is really important. And I can actually bring it up to date, because what year did Paul McCartney publish his lyrics book? Was it 22? 2021. The Lyrics by Paul McCartney. If you go to the second book and turn to page 719, there is Paul's original handwritten version of the piece that he gave to Bill for Merseybeat. And it's longer. There's more in it. So when Bill published this online on his website in the early days of the internet, Bill said that he'd assembled the piece from letters sent to him by Paul. But this essay in the lyrics book proves that is untrue. Bill probably always thought no one would ever find out, but now we know that it's not letters, it's actually just something that he gave him. Fantastic to see Paul's handwritten version of this, and marvellous information within it. And it's written in that offbeat, wacky, Lennonish prose style. Yeah. Which Paul could also do.
But they're talking about going to the Olympia to Johnny Halliday, who's the kind of thing, wasn't it?
Johnny Halliday, yeah, they went. Everyone went wild, and loud was the cheering, and many the dancing in the aisles too. But the man says, sit down, so we had to.
The Olympia in Paris, you know, only a few years later.
Yeah, they played there in January 64, but John and Paul have already been to see Johnny Halliday in October 61. Yeah, and they went to a rock festival at a club in Montmartre.
Yeah.
About which more research has now been done. I think Obadiah Jones has now dug deeper on that one. It's one of his podcasts.
Yeah.
It's just informative, but slightly, it's a lovely piece by Paul. It really is a lovely piece.
Yeah, and he sounds very much like he does today at the end, where he's going, Vince, brackets, Ron, Taylor, finally appeared and joined the fun. And in the end, he had so much fun that he had to rest. But in spite of this, it's been a wonderful show. Lovely show. Lovely.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you can hear him saying that.
Yeah. And it ends, the handwritten version ends the same way. Maybe it is all here, I can't remember now, but I remember comparing the handwritten version to the typed when the book came out.
And lots of practicing the Beatles logo.
There is more in the handwritten version, I can see it. There is more.
Yeah.
And practicing the word Beatles and writing John Lennon with a treble clef for the J.
Yeah.
It's just the stuff you do on an old exercise book, isn't it? Brilliant handwriting that Paul had and still has.
Mm. Yeah.
Taught to him by John Lennon's uncle.
What?
His handwriting. They were taught handwriting at the Institute by a school teacher called Sissy Smith, who was John's Uncle George's brother.
Bloody hell.
Boy. Yeah, I know. It goes around, doesn't it? Not many degrees of separation in Liverpool.
No. And
marvellous piece.
Final page, we have Merseyside Jazz 1961. So again, focusing on the jazz. An ad for Frank Hesse.
Yeah.
Top right, we talked about.
Yeah, the instrument shop in Stanley Street at the corner of Whitechapel for all your musical instruments and accessories. All goods available on our easier terms. Most of the acts on Merseyside bought their stuff on the drip, as it was called, on the Never Never.
Yeah.
Or as George said, like, 10 shillings down on the rest when Frank catches me.
Yeah.
the ad for the Cavern in the bottom right, because the publication was owned by the owner of the Cavern. But he was a benign owner, Ray McFall. He didn't push the Cavern down your throat in this paper, which he could have done as the owner. They've just got one ad on the back page.
It's a quarter page ad. So I'm guessing he didn't pay for that.
Probably not. Yeah. And the Beatles are amongst the acts that you could see at the Cavern, along with various other jazz and rock groups. Because this is the period when he's gone from all jazz, half beat.
Yes.
And then eventually it becomes all beat.
Yeah. Mark Lewison, thank you so much. I think you've got a book.
This one right here. This is a very important book.
Yes.
Omnibus Press published this in, I've got to say, the late 70s. 77, yeah. At a time when there weren't that many books on the Beatles. Repros of Merseybeat articles on kind of newspaper print inside, with a heavy emphasis on the Beatles.
Yes.
So it goes right through from 61 to 65, looking for Beatles pieces and pulling them into repro book, basically, with an introduction by Bill. A marvellous book, incredibly valuable book.
Yeah. It's called Merseybeat, The Beginnings of the Beatles. It's out there, and there are a few copies available, and some for like 20 quid and... Yeah.
Well, this book was a massive part of my education because I'd never, I mean, I knew about Merseybeat, but I hadn't seen an actual issue of it and I didn't know what it contained. And this was the first inkling of what it contained. In essence, it's a distortion because it's so heavily Beatles that you almost think that they didn't write about anybody else, but they certainly did. And the book was redesigned. So if you look there on page... After Bill's opening essay is the front page of the first issue of Merseybeat, with a picture of Gene Vincent signing a couple of autographs at the Rialto Ballroom. And there on the right is John Lennon's piece, being a short diversion on the dubious origins of Beatles. That led everybody to think that it was on the front page of the first issue, but it wasn't.
It wasn't, no.
So
right.
Because this book is a cut and paste job. It was actually on page 2 of the first issue. And I then had to correct, I think in the anthology they said, on the front page of the first issue. And I said, no, page 2, not the first. But they've been led to think that from this.
Yeah, yeah.
So
if the premise is to collect articles, that seems a decent way of doing it.
Oh, it's fantastic. And it still is fantastic to have this.
Highly recommended.
Very, very highly recommended. And Bill didn't have a set of Merseybeat issues and had to borrow some from All and Sundry to get this book put together.
Yeah.
But just, yeah, top marks to Bill Harry and Virginia for launching Merseybeat.
Absolutely. And as I say, if you want to read along with us, go to imtheeggpot.com where I've uploaded a PDF of this. For now, Mark Lewison, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Love to see you again and all the best.
Great to see you too. And I wish you well with your venture. The Beatles are on the opening episode of Top Gear and launched the good ship Top Gear, if I remember. So I'm launching the good ship Eggpod Express and I hope you have a very long time with it.
Thank you very much. And didn't George Harrison said, I hope we don't sink it on the first show?
He did say that, yeah. I hope we don't sink it. Yeah. I think this is a grand idea. And, I mean, Merseybeat, in essence, is a bit narrow. I mean, once you get onto Melody Maker or NME, this stuff is deep gold.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bless your heart, man. Take care and speak soon.
Thank you very much. Good luck.